Welcome back to the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. In this episode, I speak with a professional race car driver. Her name is Aurora Strauss. I'm very excited for you to listen to this episode. She's incredible. She is very young. She's a student at Harvard, professional race car driver, really a very strong, confident, articulate individual, and I really think you're going to get a lot out of this episode. It's not very fitness focused. We don't talk really about nutrition very much. She does have some really cool insights into the nutrition and strength training of professional race car drivers, but it was really just a fun episode to do, and she does talk a lot about her relationship with strength training, how strength training has helped her physically and mentally, and also professionally. So I think you're going to enjoy this episode a lot. If you do, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes. Have a wonderful day, and let's get into the episode.
Hey, Jordan, how are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
I'm excited about this, and I can already tell this is going to be better than the last time.
I'm so sorry about that, by the way. I was sure I was going to be able to make it work, but yeah, and usually the Wi-Fi on the trailer is actually very good, which is why I was sure I'd be able to make it work, but there was just no way.
It's all good. No worries. You were in your race car trailer. Is that what it was called?
Yes. So I refer to racing as a traveling circus. That's the easiest way to describe it. Okay. So my car, when it's not at the race shop where my race team is on the race trailer traveling from one place to another. And it's a one-stop shop. So that trailer has the car, a million sets of tires, every single spare part we could reasonably need. It has a little refrigerator and microwave and things like that, a driver lounge where I was. So it's like these huge, and they go across the country all the time.
That's, can you sleep on it?
Yep.
Is that where you stay when you travel? Oh, got it.
No, okay. We'll just get hotel rooms, but you can. I have. So
that's awesome. Yeah. That's super cool. All right. So I obviously know who you are, but I want everyone listening to know who you are. And so, I mean, introduce yourself. I mean, just so everyone knows, they probably know from the title of this episode, but you are a professional race car driver, which is super cool. So just do me a favor and introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Aurora Strauss. Thank you all for listening to the Jordan Syatt Podcast. I'm super excited to be on here. I'm also a fitness buff, so that's partially why I'm so excited. I actually started following you a while ago.
When did you start following me? Do you know?
Oh, gosh. It was months ago, and I'm actually pretty sure someone specifically recommended me to your page. And I know we talked about this at some point, that you were on the podcast with Danica Patrick.
Which is not
how I found you. I actually found you through a personal trainer in Boston who I was on a panel with, and she recommended me. So it's a small world. But yeah, I'm a professional race car driver. I'm running a full season this year with Porsche. I'm also a junior at Harvard. So obviously everything is remote right now. The silver lining of that is I can travel full time for racing.
That's amazing. And how's racing going so far?
It's going very well. I actually just finished my first race weekend we actually didn't finish the first race, but we finished the second race fourth, which was great. Fourth in class. It's a super competitive series, so that's pretty much all we can ask for.
Congrats. That's amazing.
But thank you. We're looking for that win, though. We definitely have it in us. So my next race weekend is end of April, and I'm a little anxious. You know, fourth place is good, but no race car driver is happy with fourth place. You want to be your either first or your last in your head. So I'm happy with it, but there's still more to go.
I love that. I feel like that's any competitor like has that, like you either win or you, like if you don't win, then you're just upset. Like you're mad. Like even if you did well, it's like, I really wanted to win though.
Absolutely. Well, and I crossed the line in fourth, and my immediate thing on the radio was like, gosh, I wish I had two more laps, right? And that's always the thought. It's never, the car was great, the team was great, but all of that aside, it's so frustrating knowing that you were almost there. So we'll get them next time.
Got it. Okay, so professional race car driver. Basically, I know a lot of this because we spoke the last time, but I want people to get to know you better. So like, how did you get into drive? Like, how do you do that? How do you get into race car driving? Like, what the hell happened? Like, what is your story? How did you start becoming a professional race car driver? That's crazy. Yeah.
So I first got behind the wheel because of my dad. I was a 13-year-old in upstate New York. And anyone who lives in the Northeast knows that black ice is real and it's scary. And so are deer. So the intention wasn't actually for me to be a race car driver. He wanted me to become a safer driver on the road, and he loved cars and he wanted to share that with me. So he taught me how to drive a manual car. I still feel really strongly that everyone should drive manual cars.
All right, we're going to have to talk about that at some point because I know nothing about cars. So I'm excited to learn about that.
No, manual cars are a totally different type of driving than automatic cars if you're used to it. So I learned how to drive with him and I just fell in love with it. My dad loved racing, but I didn't come from like a generational racing family the way that most people do in racing. So for my 14th birthday, on 15th and 16th and so on, I got a 3-day race school. And that was in Central Florida. And I actually met my first sponsor there. So super random. But the first time I went 3-digit speeds, I was like, I'm doing this for the rest of my life. It's amazing. And there's absolutely nothing. There's nothing like that feeling, right? Once you're used to something like racing, it's super high pressure, high adrenaline, and everything else in your life slows down. It's really addicting. So it was a unintentional love, but now I'm stuck. So that's how I got involved. And for this probably is worth mentioning, there are very few women in racing. When I first got involved, there were almost none. Danica Patrick is one of the few that have kind of popped up recently. Until really the mid 20th century, most places didn't allow women to compete at all. It only really started changing in the 50s and 60s. And even then, I would not describe women as welcome. So that has definitely characterized kind of my position within the industry, but I love it. I wouldn't have it any other way.
That's awesome. So tell me, why is manual the best way to drive? Like, and I know nothing about cars, so you gotta fill me, like, why do I have to drive manual? And I essentially I'd have to learn because I don't know how to do it.
So I actually teach the only sleepaway, I founded and run the only sleepaway teen motorsports camp in the world, and I make all of them learn to drive manual cars. I think that learning to drive a stick shift car makes you appreciate the mechanics of every other car more. You understand how a transmission works. You take better care of your car. You're also a less distracted driver because if you have to use two hands, like if you're constantly steering while you're shifting, you can't text. Much harder to drink coffee. I have tried that. I can personally say that like going uphill in a manual car while shifting and also holding a coffee cup is almost impossible. It just makes for safer, more kind of comprehensive, aware driving, which is why I teach every kid in it first. And if you want to go into an automatic car after that, be my guest. But I still think everyone should learn. And it's also a fail-safe anti-theft device because almost no one can drive them.
You know, I do really like the idea of, if nothing else, it makes you appreciate the mechanics of the car more. It makes you appreciate, you know, I think a lot of us talk about, you know, being present, right? And being present more and learning how to be present. It's something we all strive for. And it's things like, I think most of us look at it as a commute, as like a means to an end, as opposed to like an opportunity to appreciate the moment and whatever it is you're doing. So actually, I really like that. I think that is what just convinced me to say, listen, like there's a lot of work that went into this car. There's a lot like the people that went to making it, the machinery, like all of that stuff. When you do that, and things that I would never think about getting into an automatic car and things that I would never think about really generally, I'm not educated on cars at all. So just learn like that concept is like, you know what, that's worth it. That like you convinced me, Aurora, I don't have a car because I live in Manhattan, but when I do, I will definitely learn how to do manual just for that alone.
Well, this is a real offer. The camps that I teach are at a track called Monticello Motor Club, which is about 90 minutes from Manhattan. So if you want to, you can come learn to drive manual, but then you have to see how you stack up against a bunch of 13-year-olds that just learned how to drive manual. So there's give and take there, but I think it'd be very fun.
If that's a legit offer, I will take you up on that offer. Absolutely. I'll vlog the whole experience for YouTube because I think that would do really well. And I'm totally fine losing to 13-year-olds. I have no ego with it. So if I lose, I'm totally fine with that. That I will definitely take you up on that. After this call, we'll schedule a time for me to go there. I think that'd be super fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I know you reached out to me on Instagram. I think it must be about 2 months ago now. Just let's talk about like why you reached out in the first place and sort of like what's transpired since then.
Sure. So I first reached out to you to thank you, actually. I think that so obviously this is a fitness related podcast. And women are chronically mistrained within the motorsports industry. Mm. I think this is a whole separate conversation. I think women are frequently mistrained in general.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Particularly in the motorsports world. Motorsports is very endurance based. You need to be able to sit in a car that's like 130 degrees Fahrenheit inside, right?
It's 130 degrees inside the car?
Yeah. You sweat a lot. I usually lose multiple pounds of water weight pretty much every time I get into the car. And it's per hour. So we have water bottles in the car whenever we pit to get new tires, fuel. Usually they'll replace the water bottle because you're losing more than you're taking in constantly.
That's so it gets really crazy.
So obviously racing in general is very cardio and endurance focused, but motorsports is also one of the very few sports where women and men can, and in my opinion should, compete on equal footing. But because of that, men have the privilege to be able to focus mostly on cardio because they gain muscle mass much faster. And there's less of a focus on like, okay, if I'm turning a car with no power steering, if I'm hitting brakes with 3000, PSI of brake pressure, how much do I have to strength train for that? But women really do. So I didn't really start weight training until a couple of years into my pro racing career. And the second I started, it completely changed everything about how I drive. I'm a different, stronger, more confident driver as a result of it. And I'm also eating more as a result of it. And when I came across your page, I was like, this is totally the content that almost every woman, and particularly female athlete I know, needs to be seeing, right? Things like food is fuel, right? You need to eat in order to perform well. Things like, particularly as a woman in motorsport, because there are so few of us, like sometimes being a successful athlete isn't really about aesthetics. It's about making sure your body can perform, even if that means you're a little bit larger, or even if that means you're focusing on eating, more than you need to even, right? So I was super thankful, and I wanted to message you to thank you for that specifically. And just so everyone knows, Jordan was actually kind enough to design a training program around my racing, which is really cool. I've never actually had that done. And it's been great so far.
I want to hear how it's going. I want to hear like what's going on with your training, like what you like, maybe what you don't like, and then continue with that as well. Like is the training that I designed for you different than what you'd been doing prior?
It's less strength training, actually. I used to do 4 to 5 days of strength training a week, and now I'm doing 3, but it's more sustainable. I found that if I go 3 days a week, I consistently make it all the way through the workout. I go home, I'm happy. If I go 4 or 5 days a week, it's a bit more of I'm sure most people I know have experienced this, where you're like dragging yourself to the gym at 6 a.m. Mm. You're like, I've worked the whole day. This is the only time I can do this. It's much easier to do that if you like, I bounce out of bed if I'm like, this is one of 3 times I'm doing this. And it's left more time in my week for the cardio that I do have to do for racing. I just had my first race and it was great. I actually, in terms of the physical and mental endurance of a driver, you can tell way more about someone's average lap time than their best lap time. And I think I had the second best average lap time out of about 40 cars in our second race this weekend. So it was very cool.
That's awesome. Did you notice a difference in fatigue or in anything like within your race, like from the training, or not yet? Because it is pretty early on, to be fair.
Not yet, but I think I will. And I think, to be honest, the cars that I'm in right now, I'm doing hour-long races, but I'm going to be doing more multi-hour long races later this year. Wow. So I think that's where it will actually make much more of a difference, right? I do endurance racing, which can be anywhere from an hour long race to, I did a 25 hour long race actually at the end of 2018. It's multiple drivers. So in that race, we had 4 drivers. And for context, you do anywhere from, if it's super hot, you'll do a single stint, which is maybe the car will last like 45 to 50 minutes on fuel and tires. So you'll do a stint that can be anywhere from 45 minutes to 2-3 hours. You get out, you drink a lot, you eat as much as you can, and like super calorie dense foods, right? Like pasta, dates, chocolate, like anything, right? Anything that will just like get energy back into you as quickly as possible. And then you try to sleep and you can't because it's just too much adrenaline, but you try and then you get back in. So it's just this like endless cycle of I'm tired and I'm hot and now I'm freezing because the sweat has dried on me and I'm eating and now I'm burning it all off again.
That's crazy.
I don't know why I do this.
I've never heard of this.
When I think about it, I'm like, this sounds awful. Why do I do this? But it's really fun.
Wait, okay. So you'll drive for like 2 to 3 hours straight?
Yes.
How fast is the car going?
So the quickest I've gone in a car period is about 220 miles an hour. The quickest
You're
I've
insane.
Gone in a race
You're
is
insane.
175 miles an hour. So it's, and I think people sometimes don't realize that it's quite a workout, right? Because they're like, oh, well, I drive an automatic car on the street. That car has power steering, it has boosted brakes, and you're going like 30 miles an hour. You have air conditioning, which like once you get into a race car, you will never take air conditioning for ever again. Every time I'm in a street car, I'm like, this is so nice. So you're used to having all of that. And sometimes people don't realize like when you're turning a car through a corner, carrying multiple Gs with no power steering, no boosted brakes, it's really hard. Like my average heart rate through a race like that is generally like 140, 150 beats per minute, but it's held very consistently. And it will be more than that, you know, at the start, things like race starts. If there's a crash right in front of you, you usually see a big spike.
Yeah. I feel like, the easiest way that I could imagine how difficult it would be on your body from a strength perspective. I remember being in a car growing up, like being in the back seat. And if we weren't wearing a seatbelt, I think the game was called Jello, where
yeah.
it was like, as the car turned, you just like slam into everybody else and like squish them. And in a race car, obviously like you're all strapped in, but you've got to resist that force, which
yeah.
is magnified by, I would imagine, by 10, 20, 30, 50 times because you're going so much faster and around much sharper turns, and you don't have, I know none of the terms that you just said, like I know none of those words, but you don't have like the brake support or like whatever the
yeah.
words you use.
You very rarely have the electronics that make things easier on you when you're driving a normal car.
And why is that? Is that because they want to make the car lighter?
Usually. So sometimes it's actually dependent on the series you're running in. Some series now, for safety reasons, have started mandating air conditioning, but you almost never use it because it takes away horsepower. So
really?
Yeah, yeah. So usually it's to make the car as light as possible, but it's also, yeah, it's just very different technology, right? Some race cars are adapted from street cars. Many are actually built from the ground up. So it's just extremely dependent on what the manufacturer is. I think technically the Porsche that I run does have AC. We would never use it, but it does have it, I think.
You would never use it because it would take away from the performance of the vehicle?
Yep. Yep.
So you're just like sitting there just sweating just because like
yeah.
I need to win.
Yeah. And then you get out, and that's another thing is you really appreciate fresh air. Like you get out of the car and you're like, oh, so nice. So it's, you know, you don't take the little things for granted anymore, like turning a car easily and breathing and AC.
I have to ask, how is it, like, if you have to use the bathroom, do you have to get out of the car? Like,
okay. So I've been asked this question.
Your face
maybe,
tells
like,
me that.
So I've been asked this question maybe 2 or 3 times ever in interviews. So you hit the nail on the head. You can't go to the bath. Well, some people do. So, so in 24 hour races, I get this question a lot from other racers. It's like, have you peed in the seat? Like, have you peed in the seat yet? And that's one of those, like, you can tell if you're a super experienced decades long race car driver, if you've been in the position where you've had to pee in a seat. So yeah, it's never really a question you want an answer to. And this sounds super disgusting, but during races like that, you actually would just never know because you're sweating so much. Like you're not going to feel any difference. That seat is soaking wet. Your suit is soaking wet. In a 24 hour race, you usually wear multiple suits because they get so gross.
Oh my goodness.
So you honestly would not know, But yeah, I don't even want to know. I mean, there's the distinct possibility I've been sitting in someone else's pee and I just don't know it.
Wait, even during a 24-hour race, like when you're resting, you could go use the bathroom. But like, obviously, yes, maybe someone who's in the car for 3 hours, like you don't know if.
You don't know. And you don't want to know, right? And also, like, again, this sounds bad, but you almost don't care. Like, I can't.
I'm focused.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're a true competitor. You're like, whatever. Like, I don't give a shit. I want to win. And I don't care.
And I'm gonna, like, yeah.
Worth it.
Yeah. Everyone listening to this is finding out a lot about me. I'm like, yeah, you know, that's a fair Love trade. That.
That's a fair trade. And it's the truth, right? It's like, you don't want to sugarcoat it or lie. Like, that's the truth. And, yeah, and for, like, I've never understood anything about racing or cars. I was never brought up with it. So like, for me, it's really interesting. Like, I was completely ignorant to all of this. So it's cool to learn about this. Talk to me about strength training and how your perception of strength training, your routine with strength training has changed over the years in order to accommodate your performance.
Yeah, I think, and we've talked a little bit about this before. Part of what makes women in motorsports or being a woman in motorsports so tricky is that motorsports is 50% driving, 50% marketing, right? It's a multi-billion-dollar sponsorship-driven industry. So as a woman, on the one hand, that gives you a huge edge because it's a simple supply-demand question, right? There are very few women, so there's high demand. And women are also the majority of the automotive purchasing power in the US. So I can go to companies like Porsche or other automotive manufacturers and say, like, you know, most of the people who have the power to buy your car, the authority within the family to say, like, well, we need a car to take the kids to school, or I need a car to drive myself to work. Most of those people are actually women. So it makes me a great marketing asset. But on the other hand, aesthetics objectively play a role for women that they do not play for men. Maybe to a certain extent they play it for men. And I also am very much not in the business of, like, overly victimizing myself or other women in the industry, right? I think we actually receive more opportunities usually than men do because there are so few of us. Makes strength training and performance, it definitely all falls under this umbrella of, like, well, how do I look in the suit? So I grew up with that. I mean, I started driving when I was 13. My first pro race, I was 16. Everything moved very quickly. And I think part of the reason I didn't strength train was, I don't really think that I had, coaches around me that were particularly encouraging me to. But on the other hand, there was definitely this concern of, like, how do I look in the race suit? Will I get bigger? All of the that pretty much every 16-year-old girl I know has, right?
Yep.
So that's just the reality. But I also had the added nuance of, and I have sponsors investing in me who, like, you know, are paying attention to the number of views I get on Instagram and how many people are watching my race broadcast and my interview on, like, FS1. So it matters. And I think my relationship with strength training, honestly, it changed more once I educated myself more about it. I never really strength trained until I took a year off of school. Between high school and college to race professionally. And during that season, my boss at the time, because I was working full time while I was racing to pay for rent and things like that. She loved strength training. So I started going to things like Barry's boot camp and, like, workout classes at 6 a.m. And I was like, oh, I am eating more and I feel better and I'm driving better. So it started like that, and it slowly transitioned more to, like, very targeted strength training in the gym. And that was the eye-opening moment for me where I realized, like, no one told me this. And men are frequently training, and I've just never really received proper guidance on this, in my opinion. And most women I know don't in the racing world. The aesthetic still does matter, right? A lot of the women I know that are really good drivers and formula cars and things that are insanely physical are also larger because they need the muscle mass to be able to turn a car like that. I'm actually in a different part of motorsports where you still need muscle mass, but endurance racing is much more focused on kind of long-term cardio than it is on something like the ability to, like, it, like in Formula One, right? You just need enough muscle to turn the wheel. You just do. Right. That's, like, a very concrete limiting factor. That's somewhat true in sports cars, but much less so. So it's interesting seeing kind of how the responses are to women's strength training and kind of what sponsorship money they get as a result of what they look like. So that's super long-winded explanation of kind of what my relationship has been with it. But the long story short is I'm more confident. I'm a better driver. And in my opinion, a better mentor to other women after having learned to strength train.
How did you educate yourself on strength training? Like, what did you do to learn more about it? Like, what was that process like?
Mostly watching what men in the motorsports world did, actually. And again, there are very few women in motorsports, and it's ballooned actually the last few years, which is really exciting. And most are really young because 20 years ago, there just weren't opportunities like this. And now there are. So since then, I mean, the last 2 years, I've been able to see either, you know, even versions of what other women in the motorsports industry are working out, or like what their kind of processes are. But it started with me actually just looking through the competitors around me. And I'm like, oh, like he also, a lot of people competitively mountain bike. That's like super common in racing.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's like also the adrenaline rush, but it's also cardio, right? It's very similar, very high risk, like downhill biking is scary.
Super scary.
And yeah, it was just, I think I realized like most of these people are pretty consistently going to the gym. I'm a professional athlete. I should probably be doing that. And I was just surviving at that point, right? I'd get out of the car and like almost collapse. And I'm like 17 years old. I probably shouldn't be doing this. I'm like, I was surviving based off of the fact that I was super young and that I loved running. So I had the cardio element going for me, but I just had never been in a gym. And there's also the peer element there, right? Most high school boys go to the gym because their friends go to the gym and they learn how to lift because their friends are lifting and they teach them. No one I knew really lifted. They would go into the high school gym after hours and they'd go on the elliptical for half an hour and then they'd leave. So I think also just not necessarily, and I also didn't spend much time at high school because I was traveling so much for racing. So I think just not having the peer group delayed that process a little bit. And it was mostly watching what the male racers around me did. And at that point, my peer group was honestly male, like pro racers, which is men in their early to mid 20s, which is a whole other conversation about like how weird that is that these guys are like my brothers at this point. But most of my time was spent around like early 20s guys when I was like 15. So my sense of humor is like super twisted, but yeah, that's how I learned. And I'm trying part of this and, you know, part of, when I mentor other women in the industry is trying to teach them that, like, it's a huge privilege that women can compete on the same footing as men in motorsports. Like, that's really rare that you have a sport where like the car doesn't know the difference, right? If I turn in at X miles an hour and make it stick, it'll stick just as much as a guy's car does. Like, it's not like the car feels that. So given that, yeah, maybe we have to train differently, but it's not a question of whether or not we need to train differently. It's whether or not we can. Most women I know who have succeeded in the industry are super determined and put in double the hours that most of their male counterparts do.
In what way? Like, what do they work harder at specifically?
I would say, I mean, from a very concrete, like physiological standpoint, right? I build muscle much slower than the men around me do. So because of that, I need to make sure that I, and weight also makes a huge difference in the car, right? If I were to gain 10 pounds in the next couple weeks, the car does feel a difference, right? Like we mostly use kilograms in racing because it's all European, but every kilogram counts, right? So you need to make sure that you have enough lean muscle to compete against men for the same amount of time, but not bulk up in the same. And it's very hard, right? Like, it's hard to actually bulk up like that, particularly as a woman. That's like a lot of work, but you want to be very cognizant of that. You want to maintain lean muscle mass, make sure that you compete against men, but maintain that line in the sand as well of, I'm also going to be in this car for 2 to 3 hours. I need to make sure I'm light enough for it, that the car stays nimble, right? That a small amount of weight like that adds up a lot over time. Like, if you look at the body structure of, or just the, yeah, if you look at most professional race car drivers, particularly in the formula world, like most of the men are actually super slim. They don't have even remotely the amount of lean muscle mass, or like they're more similar to tennis players, right? Tennis players mm-hmm. don't have a ton of muscle mass, but you need enough to get the job done. So I think in that sense, I end up putting a premium on strength training the way that some of my male competitors don't, because their training once or twice a week is my equivalent to training three or four times a week.
And you think because you know you need to be stronger, and they might feel like they have enough requisite strength already.
Yeah, it's almost exactly that, right? It's also the element of like, and this just happens to be how my body seems to work. I lose muscle mass fairly easily. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. I lose weight fairly easily. So I have to put a lot of really conscientious effort into continuing to strength train, and very deliberately eating before and after, and like eating at least as much as I need to, and ideally more than that on the days that I am strength training.
Got it. Is it possible to be too big in a race car? Like, could that be a detriment if someone is too big?
Yeah, absolutely. So race seats are generally pretty small. I usually have to have a seat made because I'm too small, actually. So if you don't fit in the seat, if you're too small for it, then you can get a custom seat made around you. And it's literally, it's foam, or it's, you can have different materials, but usually it's foam, and it curves around your body and hardens like that. So I have a custom race seat that I take everywhere with me. But there is the distinct possibility that you could not fit into a race seat. Mm. It's relatively rare to see someone that's too big, at least in the pro racing world. But in the amateur racing world, people will have to order extra large seats just to get into the car. And that makes a huge difference. Like, anyone who's listening to this, if you've ever been to an indoor go-kart track, and there's like a 5-year-old kid that's lapping you, they might actually just be way better than you, but it's more likely that they're just a second or two faster every lap because they weigh so little. It's more about physics than it is about talent at that point. So that's a super exaggerated version of what I'm talking about, right? Because go-karts are really, they're light. I mean, I can lift those go-karts. So given that, it's like, it's a much easier way to see what's going on in a race car, where you may not necessarily feel a concrete difference, but even if it's worth a 10th of a second in our cars, that matters a lot. Most pro race car drivers are within hundredths of a second of each other. So if you're the reason your car is too slow, like, that's a problem.
Got it. That makes total sense. So in terms of your strength training progression, like, what did it look like for you early on with your strength training, and what does it look like for you now?
I think early on, I didn't really have like end goals and then work backwards from there, because I was still learning what I was doing, right? Most of my early strength training was Barry's boot camp, boxing class, like things that were like the classic boot camp style format of like you sprint 10 minutes and almost die. And then by the time you get to weights, you like are so tired that your form is awful and you're lifting 2 pounds and then you leave.
Yeah.
Which, no disrespect to Barry's boot camp, I actually like it, but I think it's great cardio. It's not strength training.
It's not strength training. You explained perfectly why. It's like you're exhausted by the time you get to the weights, then you can't lift heavy weights.
Right. There's a time and a place, but like the fact that people try and do heavy squats at Barry's boot camp, like, you've already exhausted your legs.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that at the time. But that was really my like first venture into strength training period. And I remember doing that 2 or 3 times a week with my boss at the time, because she was super intense and would get up at 6 a.m. and I would join her. And a few weeks into it, I was like, I feel better. I feel good. Like, I like this. So I got a membership at a gym. I started going to a gym consistently. And it actually took my boss going with me at that point, because it's scary as like I was 18 at that point. And going into a weight room at 6 or 7 a.m., you'll usually see mostly guys. And you'll very rarely see women, particularly doing upper body. And that was, I was like, I don't know how to do any of this. And I learned most of the correct form from my dad, who used to bodybuild. So that was when I first went home after I was no longer working in Boston. I spent the summer at home. He taught me how to bench press. He taught me how to squat and deadlift and all of that. And that was when I was first like, I actually really like this. I like specifically strength training. Like, I like going in and going for heavy weight and not trying to do so many reps that I'm like breaking a sweat and turning it into cardio. This is actually really exciting. And it took maybe a full year before I realized that it was actually affecting my performance in the car, to be honest.
Interesting.
But it makes a big difference, right? Like stuff like, for example, walking lunges, like that's, it's not just your legs. It's also your core, right? It's, there's a huge stability component of exercises mm-hmm. like that. Or, you actually have forced me to do pallet presses. So I don't thank you for that. I hate those. But it is one of the closest exercises you can get to simulating when a car turns and you have to hold yourself in place. So part of why I hate them is because they're super effective. So I've been doing them for a long time. But yeah, I think I started to realize really years into strength training that a lot of the exercises you're doing that like really it's like the same 10 to 15 strength training exercises can get you through life, right? But a lot of them are, I think I saw this meme at one point that was like proper strength training is just doing like the same four exercises until you just give up and die. It's like, yeah.
That's my buddy Ben Bruno. He wrote that tweet. It's exactly right. It's like you do the exact, and he trains like Justin Timberlake, Jessica Biel. Yeah. Like he's hilarious. And I remember when he put that tweet out, I laughed. I was like, you just do the same four exercises until you die. That's it.
It's kind of true. But I think people also don't realize how versatile strength training is, right? Like most of the exercises that I do obviously, and there's functional training to an extent, right? Where I might do certain motions that will correlate a bit more to my sport. So things like, holding weight like this and doing Russian twists while also specifically turning a weighted plate like you would turn a steering wheel. That's super specific. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's just like I would do the same exact strength training exercises that anyone else I know would. And it's super effective.
You bring up a great point, and I think this is something that I think people overvalue quote unquote functional training, right? And I'll say, like, I think functional training, whatever helps you improve in what you want to improve. That's like essentially what functional is. Functional for a bodybuilder who wants to grow their biceps would be bicep curls. Like that's functional right. for that person. Functional for someone who wants to, grow their glutes, hip thrust, whatever. Functional for you might be doing what like a pull-off press to help with the G forces and with turning the wheel,
yeah.
right? So functional is really dependent on the person. But in terms of exercises that like I've seen, for example, golfers, right? And I've trained some professional golfers like where they think that in order to improve their golf swing, they have to do exercises that mimic their golf swing and they'll like yeah. get a cable attached to it. And it's like, number one, that's actually a really bad idea because you're going to change your technique using this cable that can't really mimic exactly what you're doing with the golf swing. And yeah. really the sum and substance of it is people undervalue simply getting stronger. Like mm-hmm. they don't, if you get stronger, you will perform better. It is as simple as that. If your core gets stronger, it's going to be easier for you to drive that car. If your shoulders right. get stronger, it's going to be easier for you to turn that wheel. Like strength is really, and strength transfers pretty damn well. Like if you get stronger to deadlift, it's going to transfer. If you yeah. get stronger to, it's, you don't need it to be in the exact direction, force vector, plane of motion that you do in your sport in order for it to transfer. Like the body is very smart and it can transfer that very well.
Yeah. I'm going to call this out. There are these like contraptions in motorsports that lots of drivers will pay like a really exorbitant amount of money for, that it's like you're sitting in a seat that was taken from an actual car. And they have weighted versions of everything. So every time you turn the steering wheel, it's like a ton of extra weight. And every time you hit the brake pedal, it feels like you're like squatting 200 pounds. And they attach all this stuff to your neck, so it adds resistance. And on the one hand, like you're not going to lose strength doing that. But I spend a lot of time looking at that, like, okay, you just spent like tens of thousands of dollars on this. And I'm spending $10 a month at my gym just doing squats. Like,
yes,
it tends to have about the same effect. So there's lots of stuff out there in motorsports. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff out there in motorsports that tries really hard to like mimic what it's like to be in a race car. It's like, it's almost impossible to mimic what it's like to be in a race car. Just make sure you're strong enough to handle the inputs and the forces that are coming at you and deal with it from there. I mean,
yeah,
and I feel like it's frequently overcomplicated.
100%. And this, I think, is across not even just sports, but just fitness in general. People are like trying to, like, it's why people will try and do squats on a BOSU ball. It's like, well, I'm trying to improve my balance. It's like, then stand on one leg on the ground, like do a lunge.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to improve yeah. your balance, like what in regular life, you're not on a wobbly surface. You're not like, you're not like going around unless, I don't know, like unless you're on a boat all day. Like if you're not living on a boat, then you're not on a wobbly surface. Even ice is stable. Yeah. It's just slippery. Like most people, if they fall, it's like getting in and out of the shower. So maybe you should work on step ups on a stable surface instead of like standing on this wobbly ball with like bands going over your head. What are you doing? It's not, it's a waste of time. I see this in sports. For example, a really common mistake I see people do, like sprinters, I'm sure you've seen this contraption where sprinters, they'll have this parachute behind them and they'll run with the parachute. It's a terrible idea. Because when you have the parachute behind you, the wind is hitting the parachute and it's actually pulling you back. And that's changing your technique with a sprint. If you want to get better at sprinting, on one hand, get stronger, deadlift, squat, hamstring curls, like do strength training. On the other hand, sprint, practice your sport. If you want to get better at race car driving, on one hand, strength training, lift, and then drive, do your sport, drive. Like nothing will teach you to be a better driver. And I'm sure you can attest to this. There's nothing better for being a better driver than driving.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think driving, and this is true to a certain extent of all sports, but it's particularly true with driving, is that's where funding has a huge factor, right? Motorsports is, if you look at every Formula One driver, every contemporary Formula One driver, and look at their family background, almost all of them are extraordinarily wealthy. And that doesn't mean that they didn't absolutely earn their spot in Formula One, right? You have to be incredibly good to get to that point. But it's just really expensive to get in cars that frequently. So that's where it does play a factor. And I think that if anything, that's why I'm so thankful for strength training, is I think it's one of the best avenues for me as a woman in motorsport to make sure that I have a competitive edge, even if I don't necessarily have the funding to be in a car all the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. This is something I see it across sports. I could definitely see it in something like race car driving. And the other one is equestrian, right? Because those are the two things where it's like, you got to have money just to do the sport. Never mind your skill at the sport, just to do it. You got to have a car.
Yeah.
You got to have a horse. You got to have a veterinarian for the horse. You got to pay it like to feed the horse. Like it's to do the sport. Like you got to have money for the gasoline. Like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I also see this with just professional athletes in general. Usually, not always, but usually their parents had money in order to pay for private coaching growing up, right? And there are some cases in which that didn't happen. And like, God bless those cases. Like, it's incredible that someone could start like from so much further back and then like work, like beat people out who like had private coaching, whatever it is. But I think we see this, and it's not even just in sports, right? This is in general across different avenues in life. If you had the opportunity to pay for extra coaching, to have like this extra care, then of course you're going to have a better chance of being at the highest level. Yeah. Of course. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like if your parents don't have money to pay for an SAT tutor, like, of course you're probably not going to do as well as someone who did.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And it's actually, in my opinion, a huge factor for why there are so few women in racing, or why so few women who pursue racing make it, right? Is just, you know, that the key to this, in my opinion, is in the lower level ranks of racing. So things like go-kart racing, amateur racing. Most race car drivers start go-karting when they're around 3 years old. And these are fake numbers, but if you say for a second that there are like 20,000 boys who are 5 years old in the world who are go-karting this year, whose parents are putting funding in and they're trying to see if their kid's good. Which, by the way, karting parents, if you've ever seen like crazy, like dance moms, like it's so much worse. So if you have 20,000 5-year-old boys worldwide who are aspiring pro race car drivers who are in go-karts, probably about 1% of those, well, 1% of the 20,000 kids total. So let's say like 200 will make it as professionals. So that's honestly kind of a generous percentage. It will be less than that. So let's say it's even 100, right? And karting is still very male dominated. So if you say that there's maybe one girl at the karting track for every 15 to 20 boys, think about how that scales down over time. Maybe there's one that makes it, like maybe. And peer groups and networking and just funding plays a huge role in a situation like that, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a 6-year-old kid and you have a family friend or your dad can afford to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on your go-karting, great. But most people aren't in that situation. So it's not more likely for a girl to be in that situation. But if you start off with a smaller percentage of women, it just goes down from there. Mm-hmm. So I think lots of people look at the racing world and they're like, it's inherently sexist because there are like three of us. And I'm not going to deny that there's sexism in the industry, but I think it's much more of a funding game than people realize.
Mm. What about interest? Like, do you feel like there are probably just fewer women in general interested in racing cars? Like, obviously, like, totally fine if they are, but I would imagine like fewer women are interested in racing cars professionally than men, and that's just my assumption. But what do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think the nuance I would add to that is that I think that there are fewer women interested in automotive in general, because that's not really how we raise girls, right? Like, that's where networking and just how we raise kids in general plays a huge role. It comes down to the stereotype of like when dads work on cars in their garages or like fixing appliances in their house, usually the boy is the one holding the flashlight, not the girl. Like, it starts that young. And it also comes down to what your peer group is. Like, the stories of a lot of pro race car drivers are that their friends were go-karting and their friend lent them their go-kart. And boys usually hang out with boys when they're younger and girls usually hang out with girls. Mm-hmm. So it's less about girls saying like, oh, that's risky, I'm inherently not interested in it. It's more about the fact that by the time you're 15 years old, you've usually kind of decided what you're interested in or not interested in. It's very rare for a girl to like fall in love with racing at that age if they didn't have someone in their life growing up that brought them to it. And usually it's the dad, just because that's, we are still at the point where we're like early enough in the generational change that most parents don't have moms that are super into it. But I'm hoping my if I have a daughter, I'm sorry, like, she's going to be a race car driver. She needs to figure out what she needs. I am half kidding. Like, I hope that she like does whatever makes her happy, but I also really hope it's race car driving.
Interest. What if your daughter has zero interest in cars? Like, what if like you're out there, you're fixing it? Like, what if she goes the complete ops direction? Like, will you be upset about that?
I don't think so. Then it's not meant to be. I think part of the only reason I would be upset, I'd be upset insofar as I think that I've spent so much of my life already trying to convince people that, you know, there's a lot of funding going into women in motorsports right now, which is so cool. Like, it's so exciting that women are actually getting the opportunity, but that's a band-aid. Like, funding women who have already made it to the pro level is ignoring the source of the problem. Like, we were the few that made it through the cracks, right? But there are, you know, countless numbers of girls out there that might be interested in it, except they just don't know. So I actually have an initiative, Girls with Drive, that is trying to solve that, right? It's not about finding girls who are already interested in funding them. Thankfully, there are other organizations out there to do that. My goal is very specifically just like exposure. Like, I bring as many girls as I can to the racetrack each race weekend for free, and they get to sit in the car and they get to turn it on and they get to hang out in the pits and they get radios. And it's just like, here is the industry. There's tons of work opportunities, and it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. And it's more about planting the seed, right? If they do a program like that when they're 8 years old, maybe when they're 18, they go into engineering or they get a business degree and then they come back and help manage a team. Like, you just never know who's going to pan out from those programs.
Interesting. I like that. I like the idea of exposure. Like, I really like that. I like giving people the opportunity to experience something that maybe they wouldn't experience. Maybe it's because their parents don't have the money. Maybe it's because their parents just had no interest in it. Like, I love the idea of saying, here's something that you literally might not have known existed that maybe you're really good at or would be a passion for you, or who knows. But I really like that idea. And so that's your initiative. What's it called?
Yep, it's called Girls with Drive. I started it a few years ago, actually, because I had a young girl come up to me and say that she didn't know girls were allowed to race. And the word allowed, I was like, oh, it'd be one thing if she was like, oh, like, you're the first female race car driver I've met. But the word allowed was so cutting. It was like, not even knowing that this was something you could do is way worse than being like, oh, well, it'd be kind of hard, or like, I haven't met anyone who's done it. I'm a big believer in the, like, if you can't see it, you can't be it mentality, just because that was it. Like, I witnessed it firsthand. She was like, I didn't even know I could do this. Whoa. So that's part of the goal behind it, right? It's not even necessary. It's just planting the seed. And if they decide they're not interested, they're not interested. But that hasn't been my experience. A lot of them leave saying, like, this is really cool. I stay in contact with a lot of these girls and their parents. Some of them have started go-karting. Some of them are, like, doing after-school STEM programs. Like, they're super interested and invested. So it's more about planting a seed and developing the next generation of people who might. And I've always said this, like, they are more than welcome to come back to me 20 years from now if they haven't spoken a word to me and say, like, hey, can you get me in with Porsche? And I will do my best.
I love that. And also, like, I think you're giving these children something even more, and maybe even more than you realize. Like, I know, like, you're very passionate about giving them an opportunity to, who knows, maybe they find something that could be their career, right? Like, that they could literally become. But on a broader scale, I'm sure they're becoming a professional athlete is hard. Like, and to say it's hard, that's like not doing it justice, right? Like, most people will not become a professional athlete. They just won't, period. Doesn't matter. Like, just doesn't matter. Most people are not going to become a professional athlete. But I think on a larger scale, I'm thinking as a child, like, I know nothing about cars. Like, it is amazing that you're giving children an opportunity to experience cars, to have a connection with cars, to feel confident and knowledgeable with cars, to feel like self-sufficient with the car. I think it's a really wonderful opportunity you're giving people that realistically most people, and that's not hyperbole, that's just legitimate. Most people don't have the opportunity to learn this much about cars. I think you're giving people a wonderful opportunity to be confident around them and with them and feel safer with them because they understand it better. So I love that. I'll put the link to your initiative in the show notes of this episode just in case people want to check it out. Do you want to tell people where they can follow you on social media?
Sure. So I'm super simple. All my social media is just my name. And I also am awful at social media. So I only have Instagram and Facebook. Hopefully that will change in the near future. So it's just Aurora Strauss, AuroraStraus. You can also find me in the following list from Jordan's, or followers list from Jordan Syatt. And I pretty frequently will post updates there. So what you see is what you get on my social media. If I have a race coming up, I'll tell you. If I have a Girls with Drive initiative, I will also tell you on there as well. I run Girls with Drive programs to the extent that I can with COVID right now at every race weekend. So as things are opening up more and more, and I can safely bring people, I have been doing that, but it's been very contingent on the restrictions in each area locally and my ability to get people tested. Mm-hmm. That huge caveat aside, I'm hopeful that I'll run a lot more in-person programs this year. So if you're interested and you ever see a race that I'm at and think like, oh, I'm within reasonable driving distance from that, please reach out. Like, I would love to have you. I try to max out the girls at each event as much as I can. I want to reach as many people as I can. So always feel free to reach out. Thank you so much for having me, Jordan. This was awesome.
This has been a pleasure. I'm really glad that you reached out initially. I'm glad that strength training is going well. I want you to keep me updated with how it's going. So
I will.
When you need a new program, I can do it. How have you liked the Inner Circle, by the way? Like, how have you dug
it's
into
been
that?
Awesome. So I should have talked about this earlier because it's so cool. The recipes are great. I love cooking, but I almost never have time to do it. And you have lots of things on there that are super easy and like will not take me more than 10 minutes, which is great. But it also just seems like such a supportive community. Love, like, the Facebook group is awesome. It's much more of an interactive group than quite honestly I expected. And it's really healthy, right? Like, I think that there are a lot of fitness trends out there or a lot of fitness groups that are maybe not as focused on being healthy. That's like a very politically correct way to put it. And this is one of those things. It's like, no matter what your goal is, you are really wholeheartedly supported. It doesn't, if your goal is to lose 30 pounds or to like grow your glutes, that's great. If your goal is to run a marathon and perform specifically for that, that's also great. And it seems like people in the ICU are just really there for that, which is really great. So thank you for having me join. I've actually recommended it to a few friends at this point, and they also are really excited about it. So it's a great group.
That's awesome. That makes me super happy. Well, good. I'm going to put your Instagram and your link to your initiative in the show notes so people can follow you and look at that if they'd like. And again, thank you for coming on. This has been a pleasure, to say the least. You are incredibly inspirational, and I look forward to continuing to watch you grow and improve in your sport and also in strength training.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Have a wonderful night.
Thanks. You too.
That wraps it up for this episode of the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Aurora, thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure having you. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes. Those have been helping a ton, and I really appreciate everybody who's done it. And if you'd like to join the Inner Circle, you can do that at the link in the show notes or www.sfinnercircle.com.